This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The Sun magazine has been a Chapel Hill institution for more than four decades. It began in 1974 when editor and publisher Cy Safransky borrowed $50 to launch the magazine. At the time, he had no idea where he'd find funding to keep it afloat. But years later, it is clear that his vision for a personal, political, and provocative magazine brought together readers and writers alike. The magazine now has more than 70,000 paid subscribers and continues to produce monthly issues that are ad-free. For the past 15 years, each issue of the magazine has also contained a section called Cy Safransky's Notebook. It features excerpts from Cy's personal journal, and today we'll preview a new collection of these excerpts, Many Alarm Clocks, documents Cy's evolving musings on life, politics, and love. Cy Safransky, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to
Thank
have you here.
Frank. Good to be here.
So tell us about this. Sun celebrated recently its 40th anniversary. Congratulations. It was last year officially.
Yes.
But and we sort of briefly said you had some kind of vision 40 years ago. What was that? What did you think this magazine was going to be, and how has that changed?
I don't think of myself as a person with much vision. I started the magazine because I did not want to continue being a newspaper reporter. I had political convictions and spiritual yearnings and a love of good writing. And with my co-founder, Mike Mathers, we put together a first issue, and it's both, I would say, the spirit of it is no different than the magazine today, but certainly it looks a lot different, and it was rough around the edges. And my hope and my faith was that eventually we'd attract more and more writers, which we have, and more readers. I don't think I ever had in mind back then what the magazine would be like today or how many readers it would have.
Well, talk about that. I mean, we just did a whole segment on material culture and how you reflect that and render that artistically. You may not have had a vision, but you talked about a spirit of the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be embodied in the material of writing. How have the writers changed that, and how have things changed?
One thing about The Sun is that we print a good deal of very personal writing. And it is always heartening to me how people are willing to be revealing in a way that isn't just confessional, which has become pretty commonplace these days, but can write about something that is very personal and intimate in a way that strikes a universal chord, which is what makes that kind of writing so valuable, I think, and who are willing to bring the reader into dark and sometimes uncomfortable places. And that usually chronicle some change, some maybe a redemptive moment, or simply some acceptance, some compassion for the dilemma that they're in, which is really the human condition. We all end up in those places sooner or later.
That has certainly been a core principle for the magazine, if I can say the magazine has core principles.
Yeah.
Something that's identifiable in the magazine. Cy Safransky's Notebook, which is very personal, really only began 15 years ago. Tell us how that became part of the magazine.
I used to write in my notebook or my journal irregularly. In the beginning, I used to write essays every month for The Sun, and I reached a point where I just wasn't able to do that anymore. The magazine kept growing, and it was taking up more and more time. So I thought that I would see whether a way to keep my voice in the magazine would be to be more attentive to the writing in my journal, and started publishing that regularly back in 2000 as Cy Safransky's Notebook.
Now, that can be a dynamic process, because once you know that somebody's actually going to see this stuff, does that change the way you keep a notebook?
Yes and no. I mean, sometimes I'll write something in the morning and I know that I'm not going to publish it. Most of what I write in the morning I don't publish. I like to make a distinction between being self-revealing and self-indulgent. I hope that what I publish ends up being more revealing than indulgent.
Well, can I get you to read something for us now?
Sure. I can read you the first page of the book, which consists of three notebook entries. I worship alone in the early morning, my coffee as black as the sky outside. There's no rabbi here. No priest. No one is feeding me chicken soup for my soul. Here in the darkness, I won't be confused with a busy editor who whose calls are screened, who gives generously to all the right causes, who every month assembles the wisdom of the ages on the last page of his magazine. Here, I remember that so many fools like me have come and gone. We eased out of bed before our wives were up, sat on the floor, talked to God. How skillfully we bargained. How beautiful our words. Let the minute show that I'm here, that I braved a none-too-happy childhood, legal drugs, illegal drugs, organized religion, disorganized religion, toothache, stomach aches, the occasional headache, plenty of heartache, the death of my father, the death of my mother, the death of my infant son, 3 marriages, 2 divorces, and a long and utterly impractical love affair with myself. My first cup of coffee must be strong, because I want to be strong. This may be demanding too much of coffee.
That is Cy Safransky reading from his new book, Many Alarm Clocks. It features selections from a section of the Sun magazine called Cy Safransky's Notebook. Cy is going to be reading from the book at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. He's here with me today on The State of Things. Do you have a routine, and have you had it for a long time, a prayer, meditation, kind of regular morning routine?
I'm irregularly regular. I wish that I were as devoted to a regular morning practice as I am to getting out the sun every month. But I'm not. I'll go for periods of time. It's always incredibly useful when I do that, when I leave time in the morning.
Do you write in the morning? Do you prefer
to write in the morning? Yeah, I'm a morning person. Yes, absolutely.
What is the story behind the title, Many Alarm Clocks?
It comes from, it's a line from a spiritual teacher named Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff talked about our need to wake up from the trance state that we're all in. And he likened this to someone having an alarm clock to wake up. But we learn to sleep through that alarm clock. And metaphorically, we need many alarm clocks. I find that life provides me with many alarm clocks since I'm in a trance state most of the time. So sometimes it's something painful that wakes us up.
Well, and along those lines, I mean, you mentioned Gurdjieff. You've interviewed Ram Dass a number of times for the magazine and talk about other spiritual teachers. Do you wear out a lot of spiritual teachers on your journey? Do you wear them out? Which is to say, that alarm clock got me up, but I have to throw that one away.
That was
great for the journey, but now it's not working for me.
I don't think of it that way. I think that we're drawn to different messages at different times, and I don't think that it invalidates the usefulness of the message that inspired us when we were young. I still honor whatever I've gotten from any of these spiritual teachers.
Well, it may not be dishonor. It may be more like the boatman. They take you from here to there, and now you're there, and you're not going back here. So off we go.
Yeah.
You know, a new boatman.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Well, so what are some of the more memorable pieces from the archives of the Sun magazine that stick out for you? Not necessarily your writing, but the Sun magazine.
Well, some that come to mind. There was a piece reprinted by Mark O'Brien, who was paralyzed. Could barely move at all, and then he was in an iron lung, had polio, and it was a piece he wrote about trying to find a sex surrogate and about his own insecurities, and it was beautiful and really heart-wrenching. It was actually eventually the basis for that movie called The Sessions, which came out a few years ago. We just printed a piece by Ross Gay, an African-American poet. It was an essay, and it was about being stopped by a policeman, and just talking about racism and his own experience with racism, and how the anger that arises, and he feels also the necessity for compassion both for himself and for whoever might be acting in a racist way toward him. It's really very moving. Cheryl Strayed printed a piece called The Love of My Life, which was about the death of her mother when Cheryl was a young woman, and about how that sent her into a tailspin of affairs with men and heroin addiction. And it was really about the nature of grief, which is not honored as much in this culture. The idea is you lose someone, you maybe take a couple of days off from work and you get back and hit the coffee pot and get back to work. And that's not how we're built.
Well, I wonder, I'll stay right there with you and then take it back to something you said earlier about the kind of fine lines you have to honor when you're writing and reading confessional work.
Yeah.
And how social media may be changing all of that, and the sort of the difference between the kind of reflective work that ends up in a magazine versus the very confessional kinds of things, including tweets about your favorite news story, which becomes a badge of identity, right? I think this is cool, so it's me saying this is me more than getting the news story out, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think many people do feel more free to write about, to reveal things about their lives, but the extent to which that's going to be meaningful to a reader, I think, still depends on an enormous amount of work on the writer's part. The craft of writing, which is different than just typing something quickly and posting it, and the extent to which they're able to discriminate between their own narcissism and self-absorption and what might be of use to someone who's reading it.
The magazine has cultivated a strong relationship between readers and writers. Again, how important is that? You can have a lot of followers, and there might be a kind of narcissistic feedback loop, knowing that many people have seen it. But this, I think, you've cultivated a kind of deeper relationship between your writers and readers. Would you say? And was that something you intended?
No, I didn't intend anything. That's the truth. And I am immensely grateful for the fact that we have so many loyal readers who support the magazine. Because we don't carry advertising, we do pass the collection plate a couple of times a year, and we get a very generous response from our readers. And people who stay with the magazine and read it 10-20, have been reading it 10-20, 30 years or more, and who do appreciate the kind of writing, the interviews that we publish as well, which touch on a variety of political and philosophical and artistic matters.
You've tried to convey a kind of bagash and bagali, at least origin of this magazine. No intention, no vision. I never intended. Was there a moment at which, you start building readers, you're actually going to become or are a successful magazine, it will sustain itself, where you sort of took a different view and said, my God, this is a magazine. How do I keep it alive? Did it ever change for you?
I mean, this is an ongoing concern of mine. I think if I knew that it was going to grow as much as it did, I might have been afraid to start it. Because I didn't want to be working this hard back then. it is a lot of hard work, and at different times it's been a source of, tremendous insecurity or anxiety. But the fact is that the magazine is in a very, it has a very strong foundation now, and it is anything but a one-man operation. I mean, I work with a group of very talented and dedicated colleagues, and we print the work of very talented and dedicated writers who are willing to revise a piece 2, 3, 4 times to make it ready for publication. So it really is a collective endeavor.
Oh, those pesky editors. What about the decision? Tell me about the decision to go ad-free, why you decided and whether that scared you.
I had always imagined that it would be incredible to put out an entirely reader-supported magazine. And one day I just decided to take the leap. I think I don't know if I can go into the whole complicated story of this epiphany I had, but basically it had to do with letting go of the judgment that I had been making about the sort of businesses that we would have been trying to have their ads in the magazine. And I realized that there was really no reason to make this judgment. And in the moment I let go of that judgment, I also let go of my desire to try to get those ads. And I thought, why not? Let's just go ahead and try it. And I've never regretted this. It provides a kind of creative freedom. So you're putting together a magazine without being concerned about what happens when the reader turns the page and they're choking up perhaps with emotion, and then they're seeing an ad for whatever. It doesn't really matter what. It's going to break that mood. Mm-hmm. I think readers appreciate that tremendously. And another thing I like about the fact that we're ad-free is that whether or not somebody ever reads the magazine, the knowledge that you can do something in this unconventional way, because the conventional wisdom is that you just cannot put out a magazine without advertising. So I think that it's good for people to know that that's possible in whatever endeavor they might be.
Were you doing that? Were you filtering, saying, listen, we can't take an ad from this company because it's just totally...
Oh, yeah. But yeah, when we did have advertising, I would turn down ads.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it's necessarily mutually exclusive for a magazine to have advertising and to be a publication of integrity.
Right.
But the absence of it completely really opens up something beautiful.
Did you was there sort of a bump, a dip? It had to be a dip in revenue when you first did it, or did you?
Well, you know, it was fortunate that we didn't have that much advertising at the time, and so we weren't giving up a whole lot.
Well, Cy, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank. Pleasure to be here.
Cy Szafranski is the publisher of Sun Magazine. He will be reading from his new book, Many Alarm Clocks, at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. Going to be there tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. The Sun is also hosting a Better Late Than Never 40th anniversary party in August, and you can find out more details about all of that stuff at our website, stateofthings.org. And again, we welcome new listeners in Fayetteville and the Sand Hills region who are now hearing us by way of WFSS-FM. Thank you for tuning in. We hope you make this a regular part of your day. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley's our technical director. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.